Chapter 12. The first period of development of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Here, at the close of the volume, I shall describe the first stage in the progress of our movement, and shall give a brief account of the problems we had to deal with during that period. In doing this, I have no intention of expounding the ideals which we have set up as the goal of our movement, for these ideals are so momentous in their significance that an exposition of them will need a whole volume. Therefore, I shall devote the second volume of this book to a detailed survey of the principles which form the program of our movement, and I shall attempt to draw a picture of what we mean by the word state. When I say we in this connection, I mean to include all those hundreds of thousands who have fundamentally the same longing, though in the individual cases they cannot find adequate words to describe the vision that hovers before their eyes. It is a characteristic feature of all great reforms that in the beginning there is only one single protagonist to come forward on behalf of several millions of people. The final goal of a great reformation has often been the object of profound longing on the parts of hundreds of thousands for many centuries before, until finally one among them comes forward as a herald to announce the will of that multitude and become the standard-bearer of the old yearning, which he now leads to a realization in a new idea. The fact that millions of our people yearn at heart for a radical change in our present conditions is proved by the profound discontent which exists among them. This feeling is manifested in a thousand ways. Some express it in a form of discouragement and despair. Others show it in resentment and anger and indignation. Among some, the profound discontent calls forth an attitude of indifference, while it urges others to violent manifestations of wrath. Another indication of this feeling may be seen on the one hand in the attitude of those who abstain from voting at elections, and, on the other, in the large numbers of those who side with the fanatical extremists of the left wing. To these latter people, our young movement had to appeal first of all. It was not meant to be an organization for contented and satisfied people, but was meant to gather in all those who were suffering from profound anxiety and could find no peace, those who were unhappy and discontented. It was not meant to float on the surface of the nation, but rather to push its roots deep among the masses. Looked at from the purely political point of view, the situation in 1918 was as follows. A nation had been torn into two parts. One part, which was by far the smaller of the two, contained the intellectual classes of the nation, from which all those employed in physical labour were excluded. On the surface, these intellectual classes appeared to be national-minded, but that word meant nothing else to them except a very vague and feeble concept of the duty to defend what they called the interests of the state, which in turn seemed identical with those of the dynastic regime. This class tried to defend its ideas and reach its aims by carrying on the fight with the aid of intellectual weapons, which could be used only here and there, and which had only a superficial effect against the brutal measures employed by the adversaries, in the face of which the intellectual weapons were, of their very nature, bound to fail. With one violent blow, the class which had hitherto governed was now struck down. It trembled with fear, and accepted every humiliation imposed on it by the merciless victor. Over against this class stood the broad masses of manual labourers, who were organized in movements with a more or less radically Marxist tendency. These organized masses were firmly determined to break any kind of intellectual resistance by the use of brute force. They had no nationalist tendencies whatsoever, and deliberately repudiated the idea of advancing the interests of the nation as such. On the contrary, they promoted the interests of the foreign oppressor. Numerically, this class embraced the majority of the population, and, what is more important, included all those elements of the nation without whose collaboration a national resurgence was not only a practical impossibility, but was even inconceivable. For, already in 1918, one thing had to be clearly recognized, namely, that no resurgence of the German nation could take place until we had first restored our national strength to face the outside world. For this purpose, arms are not the preliminary necessity, though our bourgeois statesmen always blathered about it being so. What was wanted was willpower. At one time, the German people had more than sufficient military armament, and yet they were not able to defend their liberty because they lacked those energies which spring from the instinct of national self-preservation and the will to hold on to one's own. The best armament is only dead and worthless material, as long as the spirit is wanting which makes men willing and determined to avail themselves of such weapons. Germany was rendered defenseless, not because she lacked arms, but because she lacked the will to keep her arms for the maintenance of her people. Today, our left-wing politicians in particular are constantly insisting that their craven-hearted and obsequious foreign policy necessarily results from the disarmament of Germany, whereas the truth is that this is the policy of traitors. To all that kind of talk, the answer ought to be, no, the contrary is the truth. Your action in delivering up the arms was dictated by your anti-national and criminal policy of abandoning the interests of the nation. And now you try to make people believe that your miserable whining is fundamentally due to the fact that you have no arms. Just like everything else in your conduct, this is a lie and a falsification of the true reason. But the politicians of the right deserve exactly the same reproach. It was through their miserable cowardice that those ruffians of Jews who came to power in 1918 were able to rob the nation of its arms. The conservative politicians have neither right nor reason on their side when they appeal to disarmament as the cause which compelled them to adopt a policy of prudence, that is to say, cowardice. Here again, the contrary is the truth. Disarmament is the result effect of their lack of spirit. Therefore, the problem of restoring Germany's power is not a question of how can we manufacture arms, but rather a question of how we can produce that spirit which enables a people to bear arms. Once this spirit prevails among a people, then it will find a thousand ways, each of which leads to the necessary armament. But a coward will not fire even a single shot when attacked, though he may be armed with 10 pistols. For him they are of less value than a blackthorn in the hands of a man of courage. The problem of re-establishing the political power of our nation is first of all a problem of restoring the instinct of national self-preservation, for, if no other reason, than that every preparatory step in foreign policy and every foreign judgment on the worth of a state has been proved by experience to be grounded not on the material size of the armament such a state may possess, but rather on the moral capacity for resistance which such a state has, or is believed to have. The question whether or not a nation be desirable as an ally is not so much determined by the inert mass of arms which it has at hand, but by the obvious presence of a sturdy will to national self-preservation and a heroic courage which will fight through to the last breath. For an alliance is not made between arms, but between men. The British nation will therefore be considered as the most valuable ally in the world, as long as it can be counted upon to show that brutality and tenacity in its government, as well as in the spirit of the broad masses, which enables it to carry through to victory any struggle that it once enters upon, no matter how long such a struggle may last, or however great the sacrifice that may be necessary, or whatever the means that have to be employed. And all this, even though the actual military equipment at hand may be utterly inadequate when compared with that of other nations. Once it is understood that the restoration of Germany is a question of reawakening the will to political self-preservation, we shall see quite clearly that it will not be enough to win over those elements that are already national-minded, but that the deliberately anti-national masses must be converted to believe in the national ideals. A young movement that aims at re-establishing a German state with full sovereign powers will therefore have to make the task of winning over the broad masses a special objective of its plan of campaign. Our so-called national bourgeoisie are so lamentably supine, generally speaking, and their national spirit appears so feckless that we may feel sure they will offer no serious resistance against a vigorous national, foreign, or domestic policy. Even though the narrow-minded German bourgeoisie should keep up a passive resistance when the hour of deliverance is at hand, as they did in Bismarck's time, we shall never have to fear any active resistance on their part because of their recognized proverbial cowardice. It is quite different with the masses of our population, who are imbued with ideas of internationalism. Through the primitive roughness of their natures, they are disposed to accept the preaching of violence, while at the same time their Jewish leaders are more brutal and ruthless. They will crush any attempt at a German revival, just as they smashed the German army by striking at it from the rear. Above all, these organized masses will use their numerical majority in this parliamentarian state not only to hinder any national foreign policy, but also to prevent Germany from restoring her political power and therewith her prestige abroad. Thus she becomes excluded from the ranks of desirable allies. For it is not we ourselves alone who are aware of the handicap that results from the existence of 15 million Marxists, Democrats, pacifists, and followers of the centre in our midst, but foreign nations also recognize this internal burden which we have to bear, and take it into their calculations when estimating the value of a possible alliance with us. Nobody would wish to form an alliance with a state where the active portion of the population is at least passively opposed to any resolute foreign policy.